Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show, where business owners, professionals, and entrepreneurs gather to discover playmaking ideas for success. Your host is internationally recognized speaker, facilitator, and author, Steve Klein, who sits down with fascinating playmakers who have made themselves and their company successful. Steve will introduce you to CEOs and executives who discuss their playmaking path toward success. And now, it's time to meet this show's playmaker. Here's your host, Steve Klein.
Bill Bradley said, "Leadership is unlocking people's potential to become better." Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show. I'm Steve Klein. In the studio today is a guest who has built a corporate culture of allowing his team to achieve their maximum potential. Today's Playmaker was an early adopter and master of variable refrigerant flow technology. With us today is a president who has VRF installations that range from Brooklyn to Seattle. This great Playmaker is John Reynald. John is president of Encore Mechanical. Since 2006, John has directed Encore Mechanical toward a vision to be a nationally recognized premier installer and service company of variable refrigerant flow heating and cooling systems. Variable refrigerant flow, or VRF technology, is capable of providing heating and cooling at the same time as different zones require. VRF is the most drastic improvement in their industry in the last 50 years. These systems have changed real estate around the world prior to their acceptance in the United States and now have become mainstream across all segments of real estate because of the increased design flexibility, lower operational costs, no consumption of fossil fuels, and great zoning that provides a first defense against communicable diseases and contamination. A lot to talk about. Really interesting. John, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you graduated from the University of Florida with a degree in environmental economics. I have a question for you, a couple of questions. The first one is, was the construction industry always your first choice?
No, it never was. I graduated from the University of Florida, and I spent a year and a half doing pharmaceutical sales. And that was a good place. I learned a lot, but I found that I had to have a more tangible touch. I wanted to have more of a product behind at the end of every day or the end of every week. I had to be working towards stuff. And actually, when I was at University of Florida, I had several buddies, roommates who were doing the construction science building program there. But I was too far along, and I couldn't afford to go back and rewrite my college career. So I had to I made the commitment to environmental economics. And in that year and a half of pharmaceutical sales, I kind of realized I didn't launch the right way I wanted. I didn't launch with something that was tangible enough for me. So I literally kind of rewrote my career I graduated high school in Texas, had somebody going to Texas A&M, getting his MBA degree, and I was visiting, I was actually working in Texas temporarily, and I went to visit him, and I put together a plan to go back. I got my master's in construction management with having no work history or no affiliation with the industry besides going to get a graduate degree in it.
It seemed like it was just an interest to you then, is that correct?
It was a way for me to accomplish that thing I needed, to have tangible impact, actually design, build, project manage, plan, look at structures at the end of the day that you know you participated in.
Well, you said you graduated high school in Texas. You graduated your undergraduate at University of Florida. Why University of Florida? And then why did you make your way back to Texas via A&M?
University of Florida, really, I didn't grow up being a Gator fan. I grew into one. My family moved from Texas to Florida. I had some sort of association and needed to be closer to my family than that far apart. I moved out to Florida. I applied to all three schools that were in range, Florida State, USF, and University of Florida. Florida is the flagship school. I didn't get in immediately, so I drove up myself, met with a counselor. You know, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm trying to get into University of Florida. And I think my personal appearance, not bringing my parents sort of thing. So I kind of got into flagship school, not having much history about it. Every day of my life at University of Florida, when I would ride my bike with my backpack on the back and I'd see palm trees, I always felt like I was the luckiest guy in the world. My brother went to Purdue in West Lafayette. I visited him in January. Every time I spent a month every January I spent in Gainesville, Florida, I kind of felt like I'd hit the mother load. I was in Disney World as far as I was concerned. So had a great time there. I love that school.
We're going to talk more about how you moved from school at University of Florida and A&M into what you do now. But I'm just very interested about how VRF, or variable refrigerant flow, works and how you got into that. So first of all, tell us how it works.
Okay. Variable refrigerant flow is what it sounds like. It varies refrigerant to match the load. What many people don't realize is that we design and install air conditioning systems that have enough capacity to heat or cool on the worst design day. Therefore, 98% of the year, your system doesn't need to have all the capacity. VRF kind of captures that and actually leverages it. It takes advantage of it. So it varies the refrigerant to match the load. But if you have a 20-ton system, but you only need 3 of those tons at any one time, that system won't spend the energy to air condition the whole space. It will just kind of air conditioning or heat that smaller portion. And that's 98% of the year we live in. It does that by moving heat around. It uses refrigerant. Very similar to the systems you have in your residence, that uses refrigerant. That's a one-to-one relationship, and you're limited to by about 100 feet separation from outdoor unit to indoor unit. This is one outdoor unit can be connected to 50 indoor units, but it uses the same principle, just with a lot more complex modeling, pressures, valving, and what it does is use the refrigerant to capture heat in one space and put it in another. That's all we're doing over and over and over again. In the summertime, we're taking heat in the building, and we're getting rid of it to the exterior. In the wintertime, we're taking the heat energy outside. People don't think of it at 0 degrees, but there's actually heat energy outside, and it's getting heat from outside, and it's pumping it into the building. But in between January and August, there's a whole lot of circumstances where some spaces need cooling, like a data center, computers, or a room with a whole lot of teenage children in a youth center. They need cooling even on a 50-degree day when other spaces need heat. So we're getting the heat energy from one space, and we're just depositing it in another. And that's one of the great efficiencies that VRF achieve.
So I'm assuming bottom line is it makes the entire unit more effective, more efficient. Is that correct?
And tremendously responsive to each of the zones. So you can zone down to like half-ton increments, which would be the size of a small office. So an individual dispatcher, CEO, different positions in your company, if it's necessary, they need to have an individual zone. Maybe they're essential worker. You want them to have their own recirculating air and zone temperature control. So we can get these down to half-ton increments, 200-square-foot space. The only problem with that is, regardless of what technology is, more zoning costs more money. And so the great capability that VRF offers can be over-designed easily and spend more, can cause us to spend more money than the developer really needs us to do.
So in essence, as I heard that, if I have an office that has 20 or 30 people, and I have some people that just get cold, regardless of the temperature, or some people that are always hot, I can control their office area to be a little warmer, a little cooler, depending on that kind of person. Is that correct?
Everyone can have their own thermostat, and they can all heat or cool independent of all the others. So they can all be in cooling, or they can all be in heating, or one can be in heating when the rest are in cooling. So it really allows great responsiveness to the tenant needs.
That is very amazing the way that works. You've been doing this for a number of years. And as I mentioned in the opening, this wasn't adopted in the United States really quick. Other countries than Europe and the United States got into it. But how did you find your way to variable refrigerant flow?
I had a great career at TD Industries. And at TD Industries, I spent half my time, 5 years there in multifamily group. And in multifamily, they used refrigerant systems. And they used very long line sets. They maxed out the technology. The other 5 years of my business at TD Industries, I worked on commercial systems. Those were large rooftops, which move a lot of air, and or chiller systems that move a lot of water. When I started Encore Mechanical in 2006, I just started the business, and I got introduced to VRF in 2007. The manufacturers, Mitsubishi had been here for a while, but Daikin had just come to the U.S. in 2004-ish, 5-ish. They were staffing people. They were actually trying to do the missionary work, get the word out that they were here and this is the technology. So I had a project I was looking at out in Tempe, Arizona, and VRF would have been a great alternative for them. And so I stumbled across it when somebody asked me to do a VE. They were going to use traditional direct expansion DX residential systems, and they're trying to find a way to kind of do this so that they didn't have 120 condensers dotting the perimeter of the building. And VROF gave them that design flexibility. Unfortunately, that developer is out of Australia. They weren't familiar with it here in the U.S. until a month after I started. And then they chased me down in the parking lot and they said, John, can you give us that VRF stuff. And I was like, well, I had just installed about $130,000 worth of refrigerant lines. So I was like, I no longer can do that economically for you. But it took their corporate office in Australia saying, oh, if you've got somebody who can do this stuff, that's a good design option. But they just didn't know to trust it at first.
So you got into this because you found out about it, and it gave you direction for starting your company. You call this move the cheese type technology, which comes from the book Who Moved My Cheese. Why do you call it that?
Because air conditioning is, it has evolved over many, many years, but the technologies that we're still using today, the direct expansion, residential type, chilled water, rooftop units, they've all been maxed out. There's a diminishing margin of return on the efficiency they can gain at this point. We're tricked out. The stuff that we do with that technology, I'm sure there'll be continued improvements, but this is kind of a new approach to it. And I got to be cautious about even saying new, because it started 40 years ago in Osaka, Japan, and developed overseas before it was introduced here in the U.S. But it is taking similar technology we have in our home by using refrigerant that's carries so much more heat energy than any other media. And instead of being limited by 100 feet, we can install systems that have up to 3,200 linear feet in a single system. So it's allowing us to use the efficiency of refrigerant versus water and big ductwork and actually move that heat energy up and down 25-story buildings. We can locate the outdoor units on the roof, garages, in between. And all of a sudden, it's taking that same basic technology in the house. It's applying it in commercial development. And we're getting a lot of benefit from doing that, from a design flexibility, efficiency. You know, it's kind of like that nanotechnology that everybody talked about. This is just so much smaller. We're doing so much more work in such a smaller package, and we don't have to consume as much net rentable square footage.
Well, if this is so much more efficient, why isn't everyone doing VRF?
So there's resistance. It's catching on here in the U.S. I call it going from niche to mainstream. We were the last ones to be the adopters to it. It started in Japan and Australia, spread through the Caribbean. We think of, or we say in the business, that Europe adopted to it about 10 years before America did. And there's just resistance here that's natural. Americans, we invented air conditioning. Some argue most credit carrier corporation, John Carrier, started inventing air conditioning, by the way, in printing presses. Not to cool things, but to actually dehumidify spaces because the paper is getting too wet. But we invented some of the biggest names in air conditioning. The biggest brands are American brands and our regulatory environment. So these technology companies, most people know the technology companies that are behind the VRF. They just don't know they now lead the world in air conditioning, such as Mitsubishi, LG Electronics, Fujitsu, Hitachi, Samsung, Daikin. In fact, Daikin now is the world leading manufacturer of air conditioning. They surpassed Carrier several years ago, if you count by tons of equipment shipped around the world. It's moved the cheese. It's a brand new technology. I say it's brand new to the U.S. Within the first 10 years or so. It's now just catching on. But it takes a whole new set of – it's moved the cheese because of what it does, efficiency, what it does, zoning, quietness, what it does for design capability. But it's also so different. It requires the tradesmen to have different tools. And we have different vernacular tools, processes, and so it's such a different deal. It's requiring us to behave differently and it's follow different processes in the field.
Well, it's obvious from your explanation that you understand this very well. I also understand that you give presentations to your competitors to help them out. Why would you do that?
When we first got started, much of the work that we did or tried to do, priced out, we were came in second and third a lot. We'd come in second or third, and then when we'd follow up on the project 6 months later, we thought the job should have been done that might not have been done. And then maybe 6 months after that, we'd say, well, how'd the job finish up? And we found out they were still having problems with getting it started. So we were losing work to people who weren't fully committed to the technology. I started when I asked if we would give, and I have a lot of relationships in North Texas, so I have a lot of friends in this business, but if they'd ask if I'd give a presentation, I would literally give it to our competitors because it's more important for me to get competitors that were intelligent and were committed and understood the commitment because I kind of got tired of losing work to people who weren't fully committed, and then the owner ended up with a bad job anyways. And so I needed to raise awareness.
Well, you've made some mistakes along the way too. Tell us how you dealt with mistakes that you've made with your company and with VRF.
Some of that is just perseverance. You know, one of the major mistakes that I made was seeing the technology and understanding the complexity it would take or the commitment it would take to get this stuff installed right, and thinking that the market would understand that too. I realized that people were going to take some early shots at VRF and may not get it right. I kind of knew that. That was intuitive to me. What I thought is the market would be smarter, faster to realize that, hey, it takes a unique company team to really install these systems such that they deliver on the promises the manufacturers say. And I thought that would be by 2015, Encore Mechanic would have this reputation for doing this stuff right. And that really wasn't the case. The even as more projects and developers were choosing VRF, our commitment to doing it right just wasn't being weighted when they were making the decisions. It wasn't probably until 2018. So my mistake was I made the presumption that the market would be smarter quicker. It wasn't. And we came off doing a 6 years series of U.S. Army jobs, came to North, you know, reconsolidated back to North Texas. And we had a rough couple of years there, 2016, 17, 18. The revenues fell off. We were trying to teach North Texas about the technology more. And we just persevered. It's basically, we outlasted it.
How did you develop your leadership style?
You know, I've had a lot of great leaders I worked for and a lot of great examples. When I give a lot of credit to my 10 years I spent at TD Industries. I saw great leaders there. I read books about leadership. I looked in popular media and the world for leadership, you know, the great ones like Welch, Nick Saban, football. I'd often look at leadership, and I'm not sure that I could ever find something that actually made sense to who I was. But I also knew that I couldn't be somebody else. I knew I had to kind of figure out leadership that was parallel to something I am. And it wasn't actually until I just recently, I have an operations manager here in my office, Aaron, and Aaron kept referring to the book Good to Great. And I know of the title. I never read it until this year. It wasn't until I read that book that I realized and probably reaffirmed for myself that with my personality type and my thought processes that I could provide great leadership. I kind of knew I wanted to run a business unit or business. I knew I had that in it. I knew I had the tenacity, the drive. I knew I had the willingness to risk and outlast it, sort of thing. But I couldn't see great examples in the world that were like John Reynolds style leadership. That Good to Great book described people that care more about the team success than their own. And that resonated with me. So, you know, some of the great examples, Jack Welch and Saban, Steve Jobs, those guys were good at what they did in that moment. They were confident. They stood in front of people. They demand things from people. And I'm not a demand guy. I really want people to be inspired. I love Steve Jobs' quote where he speaks of not hiring smart people so he can tell them what to do, but hiring smart people so they can tell him what to do. That resonates with me. And so I feel like my responsibility is to create an environment where people can mature and actually hit their own potentiality and be self-driven. In the end of the day, this business has value, more value, if it's not driven on a day-to-day basis on my little micromanaging. And what a miserable way to live for me. So I know, and that means I have to be trusting, and that means I have to kind of create an environment where people can make mistakes and raise their hands and say, I screwed up. And that's so I don't buggy whip people. People laugh because I guess I say the expression too much. I'm not here to buggy whip people, nor do people like it, nor did I ever like it. So my style really comes a little bit. It really resonated to me when I read The Good to Great, and it's really about caring about the team, learning how to be great together.
It's interesting that you mentioned Nick Saban at University of Alabama, and you were a Florida graduate. Obviously, he's a great leader, but why Nick Saban? What have you seen in Nick Saban that you'd like to own as a great leader?
The results. You can tell that Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State's probably in that category. These guys have remarkable results. They've risen above the group, the larger group. So what do I like about Nick Saban? I like his performance. The actual results he's achieved are amazing. They're probably uncomparable. Clemson's right up there. I think these guys get there because they're demanding. I don't think they're necessarily trying to figure out and how to create self-directing people. They're there to follow the plan. They have in that level of competition, they don't need people questioning what to do at second down, seven to go, you know, minute and 30 left to go, and they're, you know, approaching the red zone. That is the sort of leadership that you need in that moment. And if I had to do that for a moment, a period of time, I could do that. I don't have a problem with it. But long term, it's not who I am. It's not the space I want to work. It's not the right place for VRF or a technically based company where I really need to rely on people to do the right thing when I'm not there. I need them to know what the right thing is and want to do it for the team's sake. So if I'm heavy-handed in the moment, I micromanage people, that's going to interfere with them feeling free to be good or not even be good. We're going to try to be great here at Encore Mechanical. So I really had to create Nick Saban's that's a whole different process and space. So, you know, I love his results, but it's not appropriate for where we're at.
Well, you also are a great contributor. You're an instructor. You're a board member at the North Texas Construction Education Foundation, NTCEF. You mentioned before that you train some of your competition, but because you're working with the North Texas Construction Education Foundation, it seems like you want to give back to your industry. Is that correct?
So we're going from niche to mainstream, and there's going to be a great demand in the U.S. for people who do what I do. At this point, yep, I'm enjoying our leadership position. I'm going to, from a business standpoint, I'm going to try to leverage it and maximize it, so forth. But at the end of the day, I attract people that come to work at Encore Mechanical. We're not the biggest company that has the best package, and I don't pay people the best thing in the market or the street. They come here because they like the culture, one. Two, they're fascinated. I'm attracting smart people because they enjoy the new technology. And this technology takes a little bit more patience, a lot more training, and a different way of thinking. And people like that. And so even at the Construction Education Foundation, it's labor supply of skilled labor has always been a concern for the construction business, dating back 35 years ago or so when the CEF was started. They're there to do that. But now the labor is being required and asked to do new and different things. And so as much as I can contribute in that way, it's a great way for me to leverage what I've done with Encore Mechanical and VRF to that space.
Should someone have some interest in finding out more about you and Encore Mechanical, what should they do?
Oh, you could go to my website at EncoreMechanical.com. I'm also available on LinkedIn, John Raynell, or they can call me. Office number is 817-416-2881, extension 110.
And we have that on our website, PlaymakersTalkShow.com. Well, John, thank you very much for being a guest on Playmakers Talk Show. This was fascinating.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This great playmaker we just spoke to is John Raynell. John is president of Encore Mechanical. And because of that, this has been a terrific show. Thank you again to John for being with us. And thank you for listening to us and joining us. Join us again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com, where you can get all of our past episodes. That's PlaymakersTalkShow.com. And we'll be back with more Playmakers. See you then.
You've been listening to Playmakers Talk Show with Steve Klein. Join Steve again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com for more interviews with interesting and successful playmaking CEOs and executives.